Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi. I'm on the faculty at Cornell University, and I'm joined today by my longtime colleague at Rutgers University, longer than I'm sure Professor Clark will be willing to admit, although I do have it on good authority, Bruce, that it was 1982 when you started at Rutgers University.
That's correct.
And more recently, the 2016 USGA Green Section Award winner, leader of the Rutgers Turf Program, and I think formerly known as an extension specialist in turf pathology. Bruce, it was really, really appreciate you taking the time to yak with me about a couple of very important subjects. I know both near and dear to your heart. How has the recent storm we've experienced challenged you guys in down in the New Jersey metropolitan area?
Well, I tell you, we went from springtime to back to winter, and now we're sitting on about 6 inches of wet snow. So it's put a kibosh on some of our early initiatives in terms of getting our treatments out early in the season. So it's probably going to put us back to where we would have been without the snow.
Yeah, but the bright side is you could probably sneak out some pink snow mole plots now, couldn't you?
If I dug out the snow, yeah.
Okay, so Bruce, many years ago, I think it was in the late 80s, you know, and you could probably tell me as well, you know, years ago, the kinds of patch disease problems that we faced in turf, there was this big debate about, you know, being it called fusarium patch. You had the classic couch, Dr. Vargas and Smiley conversations back then. And then Pete Landscoot, I was at Rhode Island when Pete was working with Noel, that eventually began sort of characterizing this magnaporth. Now it's called something else, magnaporthopupus or something, poei, and I see it's named with Pete and Noel. So years ago, this summer patch thing started to happen. You had not been working in turf up to that point in the late 80s. Was this your first soiree into turf, Bruce, with summer patch?
I was actually hired in 82, as you said, and I was the extension specialist in ornamental and turf grass pathology. So 50% of my appointment was turf. In actuality, I probably spent about 80% of my time on turf anyway. And then in 1990, I was switched over to 100% turf and have been enjoying life ever since.
Yes. Okay. So summer patch comes along in the late 80s. And I remember the metropolitan New York area meeting where you stood up in front of everybody with your results or in the early phases. And I remember you as deadpan straight man as you usually are, Professor Clark. You stood up there and said, the guy said, Dr. Clark, just tell us anything, but don't tell us to raise the mowing height.
That's right.
I don't know if you remember it very well, when you started researching it, they knew if they had to raise that mowing height, it was going to be hell, because I'm not even sure we were rolling regularly back then, Bruce, were we?
No, not at all. Not at all.
And so along comes summer patch, this root pathogen. How did you decide to start working on summer patch as an organism and then again sort of start to build, you know, this whole idea of a programmatic approach to solving a problem rather than just spraying it?
Sure, that's a great question. I mean, basically, when I came on board in 82, we didn't even know the true causal agent, as you said, of summer patch. It was still called fusarium blight. There was still a lot of controversy in terms of what the pathogen was. And thank goodness, you know, Pete Landscoot, when he was getting his PhD with Noel Jackson up in Rhode Island in the mid-80s, he pretty much put an end to all that. He verified once and for all that the true causal agent was Magnaporthy poei, which is a root-infecting disease. And his work set the foundation for all the good work that was done on summer patch in the 90s. So I really appreciate what Pete did for us. And so essentially, the reason I worked on summer patch was because that was probably the top disease. People were losing their jobs. Superintendents were losing their jobs, couldn't control it, even with some of the better fungicides. Had no idea what the pathogen was. It's really hard to develop a BMPs if you don't know what the true pathogen is. So, so as soon as Pete came through and identified the causal agent, we jumped on it. And root diseases, as you well know, are not nearly as easy to work with as foliar diseases. They take 6 to 8 weeks before they show any visual symptoms above ground. And once you see the visual symptoms, the roots are shot, so you really can't do too much. So, you know,
Well, that's right. And you often don't see those symptoms until the plant goes under some sort of severe stress.
That's right. That's right. So we started from ground one. We started looking at adaptive factors like influence of soil pH. We started looking at influence of compaction, aerification, and then we moved on to fertility. And it was just, you know, one after another, sort of building upon the foundation that Pete Lanskood set.
And I remember a couple of things that maybe, again, you might not have remembered that comment about raising the mowing height. The other thing I recall, when Heritage came to the market, when Azoxystrobin came to the market at that period of time, you know, that was one of the first things. I remember talking to Paul Zwaska, the groundskeeper at Camden Yards when they first built it, and he was debating bluegrass versus Bermuda grass back in the early 90s. And you know, he said, well, you know, now that we've got Heritage and I can control summer patch, I can have Kentucky bluegrass. So certainly chemically, that was a big shift. But you, again, as you said, I recall you looking at acidifying fertilizers. And then I also recall the manganese sulfate. Is that as predominant manganese like it would be for take-all? Is take-all the summer patch version on bent grass? Tell me some of the things or the way these are connected culturally, right? When you looked at fertility, you looked at things like nitrogen source and I think micronutrients. So clarify that nutrient component for me if you can.
Well, sure. Yeah, that was something that we looked at, and it was clear if you looked at the literature on some of the root diseases that affect edible crops like wheat, that pH had a big impact on fungi like this. And the ectotrophic root-infecting group of fungi, which would include pathogens like the take-all patch pathogen that you mentioned, the summer patch pathogen, necrotic ring spot, and even on warm season grasses like spring dead spot and Bermuda grass decline, they're all lumped into fungi that grow on the outside of the root, thus, you know, the term ectotrophic. And, you know, essentially the common thread for most of these is that they're strongly influenced, stimulated by high pH. So we knew that that was likely what was going on, but it hadn't been demonstrated. So we worked on pH and we showed that high pHs enhance the disease. And if you can maintain the pH around a target between 5 and 6, you saw a dramatic reduction, not complete control, but a reduction in severity. And that sort of, you know, led us on to some of the additional work with compaction, you know, anything that reduces the root quality, the root volume, and the plant health is going to be, you know, theoretically would enhance disease. And sure, we showed enough that compaction and disease go hand in hand. So it was a slow evolution of the work that we started working on, and we based a lot of our initial theories based on what we knew in agronomic edible crop type system.
Right. And you know, it's funny because you mentioned aerification, and obviously anything that's going to allow the root system to maybe be more expansive. And I don't know if you'd consider suggesting that a more expansive root system could probably tolerate some root loss, because it's probably hard to control every bit of infection that occurs to this root system. Bruce, I also remember you saying years ago when the injection, the water injection cultivation equipment came out, I could have sworn I saw you did a study where they were looking at injecting it and you liked it. And I could almost swear I heard you write or say that you could really reduce the rate of the material you have to apply if we were able to sort of push it down a little bit with like that injection technology. Is that never took off? Am I recalling that right? And if so, how come you thought that never took off?
Well, I tell you, you are right. We did play around with that quite a bit. In fact, when the Toro Hydroject first came out, we started using that. We had 3 units that Toro had loaned us, and I rapidly decommissioned 2 of them in a week because the pumps were not designed to put in products, especially emulsifiable concentrates, which are very corrosive. So, you know, basically we switched off to some prototypes that other companies were developing for for pesticide injection, particularly insecticides. And we found very clearly that if you could place an effective fungicide just in the point of activity where that infection is taking place, that you could, in fact, reduce the severity of that disease or prevent it with reduced rates. The caveat we found was that certain types of fungicides, particularly DMI fungicides, particularly propiconazole, got tied up very quickly in high organic matter soils and therefore was almost deactivated if you injected it. So the injection, while it helped with, say, products like Dystrobal urine fungicides like Azoxystrobin Heritage, it didn't work very well with the DMIs. So, and as you said, the technology, the equipment was expensive, and I think it just didn't take off, and therefore it's not really as commonplace as we had hoped it was going to be later on down the road.
And but, you know, conceptually, the idea that, you know, the summer patch, many of the root pathogen problems we have, or even fairy ring problems, the biggest challenge we have is getting the material down to where it has to be effective, because almost all these materials, as I understand it, move acripetally up in the plant. So to get protection, you know, that would be something in some ways, if we could eliminate having to do a drench like that, would seem like a favorable thing to do. Now, since we're talking about the soil, I also have picked up on something recently that one of the scientists' careers that you impacted years ago in the anthracnose project that we're going to talk about in a minute has been doing a little bit with aerification and summer patch manganese applications. And one of the things I picked, a little caveat I picked up out of one of his studies was the timing of when they aerified actually exacerbated the summer patch in one particular year. Now, I don't know if John Inguijato at the University of Connecticut is who we're talking about here. I don't know if John followed up on this, Bruce, but before we take a break and get a message from the sponsors, I wonder if you couldn't talk a little bit about, are you aware of what John's doing, and are you wondering what that effect might be, if I got it right?
Yeah, actually, I'm very aware of what John's doing. As you said, John was one of the graduate students who worked with Jim Murphy and I on the anthracnose work, and he's doing some outstanding work on summer patch, sort of revisiting the early work we had done where we had showed that aerification reduces the severity of summer patch. The key here, though, was we worked with hollow tines. We worked with hollow tines, aerifying in the spring and in the fall, or spring and fall treatments, and it showed over a period of several years you could reduce the severity of the disease. We also looked at manganese, which you talked about earlier, and didn't find that big an effect, but in all honesty, the soils we were working on pretty much had sufficient levels of manganese. And we now know, after we did the work with take-all patch, and now later some work with other diseases, that where manganese tends to be a benefit is where you have insufficient supplies in the soil. And if you add
sand-based systems.
Exactly. And so for our take-all patch work, we were working with sand-based fairways, natural sand, coastal plain-type sands. And so they were really depleted in manganese. So when you added manganese as a foliar application for take-all, you saw a tremendous reduction in disease. For the summer patch work we were working on heavier soils. It had plenty of manganese in there, and we couldn't get the manganese low enough to show a benefit from adding more. So it was almost like a vitamin type, you know, we didn't have a vitamin deficiency, if you will.
Right.
But the interesting work that John is doing is actually he's revisiting the manganese work. He's actually working on some sand-based systems on greens with annual bluegrass. And essentially what he's showing is that manganese can, in fact, give you a tremendous reduction in disease if manganese is deficient in the soil and the rooting profile. The other interesting thing he's finding is that there's a big difference between aerifying with solid and hollow tines. If you aerify with solid tines, in some cases, you're actually enhancing the disease. And I think this harkens back to, think about it, if you're aerifying with solid tines, you're punching those tines into the ground, and if you don't change the depth you're aerifying, just keep going at the same depth, you essentially get a plow layer at the bottom. And essentially, it's like a hard pan, which essentially the root system is impacting, but it's trying to go deeper. And I think that's one of the reasons why John was seeing with solid tines actually an increase in the disease. But interestingly enough, where he was solid tining without adding manganese, increased disease, where he was solid tarning with manganese applications, he did not see an enhancement. So it shows the interaction between a micronutrient and a cultivation practice, which is cool.
Yeah, and we are just getting started here, frankly speaking, with extension specialist in turf pathology, my old pal Bruce Clark at Rutgers University. We'll be right back after a message from our sponsors. This is Frankly Speaking.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves services ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm joined today by Extension Specialist in Turf Pathology, Dr. Bruce Clark at Rutgers University. And we left our conversation, Bruce, finishing up summer patch. And I wanted to take you on this conversation because this is my own personal history with your work. And so that when the basal rot anthracnose epidemic came up. Now, you know, if you asked a guy like me who sort of came of age as a turf scientist in the late 80s, early 90s, I would tell you a lot of the epidemic that I believe result, you know, the epidemic anthracnose problem we were seeing was very much correlated to how dramatically lower we started mowing putting surfaces when the new bent grasses were introduced, and everybody wanted to mow lower. Mowers were being designed to mow lower. Up before then, it was just a few guys who would take the old Jake 22s and put a cement block on it, like at Oakmont, and skin the greens until you got POA that look like what they have. But that push to low mowing, the drop in nitrogen rate, both of which were designed to sort of keep pace with the insatiable desire for green speed, immediately led to these widespread catastrophic failures to a disease that, when I was growing up, you only got anthracnose in the Met area after the annual bluegrass weevils were finished chewing on your edges of your fairway. That's where you saw anthracnose when I was growing up, Bruce. So along comes anthracnose. Tell me, would you say that its evolution as a major problem, you know, could fit into the package I just tried to put it in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, look, superintendents don't want to hear this, but it's undeniably a self-induced problem, self-inflicted. At least it was in the late 90s into early 2000s. The desire for increased green speed is exactly what you said in terms of incredibly low mowing heights, incredibly low nitrogen levels, running the greens extremely dry, all for the sake of ball speed, made a disease which has been around. It's documented, first documented in 1908, so it's not a new problem. I'm sure it was around before that, and it was always a insignificant problem. If foliar anthracnose was around, it's on old senescing leaf blades, never much of a problem. And all of a sudden, in the late 90s, early 2000s, when we started doing this work, it became the number one or two problem on annual bluegrass putting greens. So out of nowhere, this disease rears its ugly head, and it was definitely self-inflicted. And we were pushing.
And so two things that that to me are pertinent here. One is it was sort of an insignificant thing because, as you said, you'd see it on halfway dead leaves that were already senescing. So like, okay, I think sometimes when I hear of curvularia problems, Buckley will say, yeah, after the ryegrass has just about had it, it gets curvularia. And so I think about anthracnose, like, first of all, those plants have to be in a pretty weakened condition. And second, this is a pathogen that goes right for the nerve center, the crown of the plant. Is where all the growth is emanating from. So if you're in the pathogen business, you're going to be you're a particular kind of pathogen that's going right for that growing point. Is it a stress-induced, as you say? You know, we thought at one point, I think, again, Pete did this work after when he was at Penn State. Lance Scoot did that work where he was puncturing the crown. And I think your first bit of work into this was to demonstrate whether it was a wound fungus or not.
Right. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. You know, the dogma when we started this work, the general consensus among everyone, including turf grass pathologists, was that this was a stress and a wound-induced disease. And we were all 50% right.
That's right.
The 50%, and that's a failing grade, by the way.
That's right.
The 50% we were right is it's definitely a stress-induced. Anything that weakens the plant, such as, you know, low nitrogen, low mowing heights, heat, this is definitely a heat-induced disease as well for the most part. Anything to weaken the plant would translate into more anthracnose. But the one thing we had dead wrong was this is not a wound pathogen. And if you look, and as we go on the conversation, I think it'll be pretty clear that we have multiple areas of research, which in different areas of our cultural management research, which clearly shows this is not a wound-induced pathogen.
Well, right. And I guess since we're on the wound thing, we don't have to go in chronological order, Bruce. But, you know, and I want to talk about the scientists that have been trained in this work. But since we're talking about the wound and the top dressing, I believe this was Inguajardo's work. When John was with you, you know, this was the thing. People would back off top dressing during the summer months on primarily annual bluegrass putting surfaces in the north. They back off top dressing because the thought was the abrasion brought anthracnose. And this is a good example, again, of how you have a preconceived notion, but you don't really know until you test. And along you come, you test it. John, you know, has those beautiful pictures that explains basically how the sand is keeping the mower away from the crown of the plant. That's a really classic example of how you have to ask these questions. Like John did with the manganese, you also did with the top dressing. Intuitively, we stopped, and yet it turned out to be best to continue.
Well, I tell you, if I can comment on that, I'd like to, because that's actually probably the biggest surprise in my career. I've been a rector for 35 years. Without doubt, that was the biggest surprise. Because if you look back, even in the compendium, which Dick Smiley and Peter Noder and I wrote, the first edition, and even the second edition, I believe, clearly says, if you have anthracnose, do not top dress. That was everybody thought that was the case. Well, when John came along, we started working on mowing practices, influencing anthracnose, nitrogen practices. And then we said, you know, we looked around. There's no research data to support the top dressing. So the theory was, okay, John, you know, why don't we get a quick top dressing study going, prove what we all know, that it enhances disease, and then move on. Well, John, we designed the first study. He put out the sand top dressing, and he comes back to us and to Dr. Murphy and I, and he said, there's something wrong here. He says, this is actually reducing disease. And I remember Jim Murphy and I saying, John, you got the plot plane backwards or something, because it can't possibly be happening. And you should see the result, the response we got from superintendents when we started talking about this at the Met meetings. I mean, they looked at us like we were crazy. And we've been telling them for years, don't sand top dress. That makes sense. You're going to abrade the turf, get more disease. And here we are saying, oh, new research. Sorry, guys, we were wrong. You can actually top dress. And actually, the more top dressing you put on, the quicker you put it on, the less disease you're going to get. That was a head scratcher for them. And they didn't fully appreciate that for at least 3 or 4 years.
And I think also, you know, because it was something when you look at the data just on the top dressing thing, since it is now the most surprising thing in your 35-year career that I've stumbled across, it's not that you don't get anthracnose necessarily, but that you're able to lessen the severity over time if you continue to top dress. So I think that's the thing too. If they're on a decent spray program, they should be able to keep it at bay. But the top dressing is the key for sort of sustaining that safety through the season.
And it also, if you put the pieces of this BMP puzzle together, your cultural practices, and top dressing is one of the key ones, will actually let you reduce your fungicide usage in our study over a 3-year period up to 80%. So,
go ahead.
I was just simply going to say that, you know, when we first started doing this work, We had no idea, you know, really what a good anthracnose fungicide was. And there were superintendents, I kid you not, piling on the fungicides and getting very marginal control. And so it wasn't until we started looking back and started doing some of the cultural work. And the premise was, when we started this, Frank, back 16 years ago, the premise was that if we got our BMPs in line, we got our cultural practices where it needed to be, we were predicting that we could dramatically reduce fungicide usage. And it wasn't hard to predict that because they were getting lousy results with tons of fungicide use.
So you wound up taking the safe bet on that deal. There was no chance you couldn't reduce the input. Now, you mentioned the word BMPs, and I want to get there in a second because this really important paper just came out that I want everybody to be aware of. But I want to go back and talk about species for a second, right? So I think a lot of guys will be listening to this program around the country, around the world, and say, well, yeah, it's an annual bluegrass thing. And yet, your former graduate students that have worked in the South, Lane Treadway, I believe, when he was down there, he was finding it regularly on bentgrass. So I'm wondering if that's just another manifestation, Bruce, of the stress environment that plants can be under and get a type of basal rot anthracnose.
Well, I would agree. And in fact, if you look at bentgrass where it's under tremendous consistent stress, especially heat stress, such as the Southeast or any of the transition states into Kentucky, what have you, you'll see that bentgrass is not immune to this. And in fact, we regularly get this disease on bentgrass as well. Certain cultivars are more prone else than others. And so this is, annual bluegrass is by far and away more susceptible than bent, but bent surely gets anthracnose. And so we're seeing the same impact of cultural practices on the bent.
And so that leads me to the connection between your summer patch work and your anthracnose work, right? So eventually, you know, you recognize these cultural practices. You sort of, it seems to me, have looked at ecologically, you know, what's been going on with these pathogens. And then it becomes, like with summer patch, now anthracnose, this sort of systematic approach to sort of tackling the various aspects. And, you know, I could talk to you for 2 hours about the 16 years of research, but you did such a wonderful job recently with Murph and James Hempling in this recent publication exploring its best management practices effect on anthracnose disease. Was published just this March of 2017 in Crop Science. So in this paper, you took that 16 years of work and must have said these were the three big ones that were the things that superintendents kept asking about, because these were the ones that were going to affect the reason they got into this mess, fast greens. These are the three things that are going to impact fast greens: mowing, nitrogen fertilization, and top dressing. Now, I know, because I, you know, pay attention to everything you do, you did PGR work, you did specific traffic work, you've done irrigation work, various types of mowing and rolling pieces of work. But you picked these three to study in this particular BMP. Did you pick them because they were, you thought, the most important, as I said, for green speed, or was there something else behind why you decided to set up this system study for 3 years?
Well, we picked them because they were, out of all the cultural practices we looked at, as you said, we looked at quite a few of them. These were the three which had the biggest determinants of affecting anthracnose. And indirectly, that's probably because those are the ones that they were lowering to increase green speed and stress the plants. So we found that, yep, they may be affecting green speed, but they're tremendously being affecting anthracnose severity. So we picked them because they were the biggest three factors in terms of impact on the disease.
And over a three-year period, you essentially did the various permutations of low-mow, high-mow, low-sand, high-sand, low-end, high-end. And, you know, the low-mo was very aggressive, set at 90 thousandths of an inch. That's a very aggressive low-mowing height. And when I look at this, I've been so thrilled. I was talking about it when I was doing a putting green presentation, Bruce, just recently in Rhode Island. What's so cool about this is it gives you a sense of what your cultural system is setting your fungicide program up for. Because you and I know where you're growing annual bluegrass, there's generally going to be a fungicide program in place. A lot of it is going to be to protect against this particular pathogen in a fairly large golf market throughout the northern hemisphere where POA grows. This looks like, to me, you've concluded, you found a sweet spot where you can get the performance you need from a low-mo, low-sand, as long as there's high-end. High-end helps you overcome some things. Mowing helps you overcome some things. How would you say, your conclusions over the three-year period, it sounds like you've got what you set out for. A BMP that gives them the speed they want without creating too much disease.
Right. Yeah, essentially, looking at those three factors, we came to the conclusion that the most important factor, which you do not want to change from a BMP, would be nitrogen fertility. Spoon-feeding nitrogen is probably the most important cultural practice that a superintendent can follow correctly, that is, if they have anthracnose. Now, having said that, if in fact you can follow all the BMPs, you're going to see the biggest reduction in disease and the biggest savings in fungicide. But if you're constrained and you need to maintain low mowing heights, you're better off lowering the mowing height than lowering your nitrogen. And I think that was probably one of the biggest take-homes.
And the thing that we're having this conversation and superintendents are listening. And a pathologist and an agronomist just said, well, more nitrogen. Oh, yeah, sure, it's easy for them to say. They don't have to worry about green speed. And yet in your green speed assessments, the low mowing overcame any potential problem that nitrogen had. In fact, you didn't find a profound effect on changing your nitrogen rate, did you? Well, relative to green speed, ball roll.
Basically, the deal here is if you're – and I'll just give a little quip here, because the USGA agronomist when I first started this used to say that Primo is a license to over-fertilize. And I would correct some of these guys, say, no, from pathology perspective, Primo is a license to fertilize properly and give the plant what it needs to reduce anthracnose. And so essentially, if you're maintaining adequate nitrogen and you're using a vegetative suppressant such as Primo, and there are other ones out there, essentially, what you're doing is you're giving the plant what it needs in terms of fertility, but you're regulating the growth enough so you can maintain adequate green speed.
And so, with that as a backdrop, Bruce, now that this work is out there, do you feel like now when superintendents do take a risk, they can at least look at this and say, this is the level of risk that I'm assuming when I start playing around with these big three things? And I'm also wondering, since you brought up the PGR thing, seed head suppression and it has shown effects, how you water has shown effects. I know Primo has been an important part, and especially with the seed head suppression, when they stay on a Primo program during the season, that seems to provide some suppression as well. So, Do you feel like this is a way of telling guys the kind of risk they've got with just focusing on these factors?
Yeah, I think to a large extent, now that we have studied these factors, studied the influence of PGRs, the influence of cultural practices, good chemical practices, now superintendents at least have the knowledge where they can make informed decisions on how they want to change some of these practices. Ideally, I'll tell you right now, if they follow all of our BMPs, they're going to see very little anthracnose and very little fungicide use. In fact, I'm to the point now, if you employ all the VMPs, I'm to the point where I thought I would never say this, but I'm comfortable scouting areas where you've had anthracnose and going chemically with fungicides on a curative basis, not a preventive basis.
Whoa.
And there are people who might disagree with that, but I can tell you, if you're going to pick and choose which VMPs you want to use, that's probably not the case. But if you're willing to use rolling, increase frequency of cut, and follow the VMPs to the letter, you're going to be able to go in most cases with curative applications, well-timed based on scouting, and get excellent control.
You know, and since you say it, you know, this is exactly the kind of thing that I think if we talked about it right with superintendents, this could be the basis of a conversation in a lot of Greens committee meetings where they could say, how are we aligned with the BMPs for this particular disease that many have been struggling and spraying with for many years? I would hope that, you know, that would be, do you see it possibly being used or could be used by superintendents for that purpose of sort of saying, hey, this is what the best minds in the world for the last 16 years have been studying, and they've concluded, you know, this. When a guy like you says to me, Bruce, maybe we don't need to spray preventatively anymore for this otherwise lethal problem, that seems like it ought to be a point of discussion for the golfing community.
Well, I think it should be, and I also think that realistically, practically speaking, what I just said makes a lot of sense as a goal. I'm not telling superintendents, hey, you know, ditch your preventive applications, go cold turkey. What I am saying is, as they get comfortable with the BMPs and, you know, following them, they'll see the pressure go down. They should feel more comfortable at least extending the intervals between applications and then eventually start to reduce the rates and then eventually go to a system where they're only going scouting and only spraying curatively when they need it. And I think that's a gradual evolution that a superintendent has to feel comfortable with. No one's going to ditch their preventative applications if they've gotten burned with anthracnose in the past until they feel comfortable doing
well, so. Well, I would love to go to a message to our sponsors because you tied this up so neatly in this segment, Bruce. But I want to, because it's a podcast and we get to decide exactly how we want to do it after the fact, I want to ask you about it, about what it's meant to have all the scientists that have come through your program, through the 16 years of this project. That's got to be the thing that resonates. Me knowing you the way I do, that's got to be the thing that resonates with you the most. The young people that and the scientists you have there at Rutgers, but certainly the ones that have passed through there. Can you talk a minute about how that what that's meant to you?
Yeah, that means a tremendous amount. And really, I just want to you know, give a shout out to also all my colleagues, you and people. You know, our colleagues are turf pathologists, agronomists who worked on this project. It just wasn't Rutgers. I mean, this is a multi-state project with 12 universities involved, including University of Guelph in Canada. We had people working on all facets of this puzzle. Rutgers probably had the lion's share of it, but, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, essentially just highlight the fact that this was a team effort from really outstanding scientists from throughout the United States and Canada. Having said that, I'm really proud of the fact that Jim Murphy and I working together, and I think that's a model for how a pathologist and an agronomist should be working together. You know, I think too many pathologists think they know everything and they work alone, and quite often what happens is that they'll come out with recommendations which make sense from the pathogen standpoint, but agronomically sometimes there's something missing. Working with Jim Murphy, who's an outstanding agronomist, I think we've been able to come out with recommendations which are agronomically sound as well as, you know, really hitting the mark as far as the pathogen goes. So that's been great. And you asked me about our students. I mean, gosh, you know, we've had outstanding students. We've had outstanding support from the industry, Tri-State Research Foundation, the Met golf courses, the New Jersey superintendents. Superintendents in the entire Tri-State region have put tremendous amounts of money into our research and others. And that's allowed us to hire graduate students to really work on the nitty-gritty work that, you know, we just don't have time to do with everything else we have to do. And so people like John Inguajardo, and he's now turf pathologist at UConn. He was a fabulous student. Joe Roberts, who now is the turf pathologist at University of Maryland, did a lot of that top dressing work as well as the nitrogen work. James Hempfling, who came out with that BMP paper you just talked about, has been doing a lot of work in this area.
Yeah, I mean, Chaz Schmidt, and you know, there's all this other components, too. I mean, the fact that you're working near Jim, you're working near Bingrew, who's got Emily and Michelle DaCosta coming through there. I mean, you know, listen, you know, anybody that takes the time, and we're going to go to a break, I'm going to embarrass you and then go to commercial, but, you know, I watched the video from your Green Section Award there, and the thing that resonated with me is, you guys have the best turf grass program in the world down there. And a lot of it is because of the way you have collaborated across with a lot of different people over a lot of years. And of course, Reed Funk and Indyke and Ralph Engel, all the old timers, you know, they had imagined, I would hope they would have imagined it would have been in your hands and done so well with you being the leader of that turfgrass program down there at Rutgers, as Bill Meyer so aptly said in that video for your USGA award. So we have one more segment to go here with Professor Bruce Clark at Rutgers University. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject, the only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm here with Professor Bruce Clark, the Extension Turf Pathology, Extension Specialist in Turf Pathology at Rutgers University, 2016 USGA Green Section Award winner. And as I was embarrassing him at the end of the previous segment, and we were rattling off all the people he would like to deflect much of the praise to, and I'm perfectly happy to play along with him deflecting the praise because he has worked with some special people. Just like in the Academy Awards when they rush to people off, I got Bruce done before he could mention a few names. Who else should we be thinking about, Bruce, with anthracnose? Chaz Schmidt, I know for sure.
Yeah, this current students, I mean, we mentioned some of the really good students in the past. We've had, you know, excellent students in the past, but just some of the current students who are doing some of the great work right now with soil pH and potassium impacts on anthracnose and that type of work. We mentioned James Hempfling. You mentioned Chaz Schmidt. Rennie Wang was another person who did a lot of the sand top dressing work, and now Kyle Genova is tying some of these BMPs up. So we've been very fortunate to have great students and great support, as I said, from the industry.
Yeah, and you're exactly right about the support from the industry. This has been a problem that I know from the years of working in the metropolitan New York area that the tri-state has really been very supportive, and as they should be. It's a particular issue that's affecting their ability to provide that golf course to their members. So now we're going to make a hard transition, Bruce, because in addition to your leadership of the Center for Turfgrass Science at Rutgers University, you're the current president of the International Turfgrass Research
Society. Yep.
Group? I don't even know. International Turfgrass Research Society. Right, ITS. International Turfgrass Society. And we're about to hold our 13th annual convention in the New York metropolitan area, led by you over the summer in July of 2017. I believe it's the 16th to the
21st.
I got to get the dates right. Yeah, to the 21st. Right. Okay. So, Professor Clark, what are we in for in the metropolitan New York area with the research conference coming this summer?
Well, it's a rare opportunity. This is a conference, as you said, it's held internationally. It's held every 4 years. It started in 1969. This is the 13th annual conference, and it hasn't been held in the U.S. since 1993. So this is an opportunity for people who have never been to an international conference and want to attend one close to home. This is a chance for them to see it. And we estimate having about 500 people. This is people from the industry, turfgrass scientists, students from 26 countries descend on New Brunswick, New Jersey on July 16th of 2017. And we've been planning this. This has been in the works for well over 8 years. As you know, you bid on this like you bid on the Olympics. And essentially, we won the bid 8 years ago. And here we are, 4 months away. And things are coming together really well. And I appreciate you bringing it up.
And so I wanna talk a little bit about it, because of course I could make the joke, Bruce. You won the bid back when James Gandolfini was playing in The Sopranos, so everybody knows why New Jersey got the bid back in the day. But I joke, you are right. You know, we have had it in China, in Chile, in France, in Japan. I believe after you, it's Maria Strandberg in Copenhagen. So international flair, I would say not just your typical scientific conference. It has a theme. We've got some interesting keynote speakers talking on the challenges of a changing environment. One in particular that's talking about the phytobiome and particular manipulations that young scientist is talking about making to maybe alter how plants and fungi interact, that benefits the plants in particular ways under stress tolerance and stuff like that. So really smart people coming even outside the turf industry. So talk about the keynote speakers and that challenging and changing environment session.
Oh, yeah, we have some outstanding. We have four keynote speakers. As you said, the talk on phytobiomes, that's the hot topic in science today. And we have, we have some coming in who's going to be giving an outstanding talk on that area. And it's really going to give an opportunity for people to see just how the microbial community can just shape not only plant health, but also its response to stresses. And we always talk about, impact of fungicides, impact of insecticides, impact of fertilizers. But there's a whole microbial community that affects plant health that we haven't even begun to understand. So this is a cutting edge topic that we're really looking forward to.
And I see you're also bringing over a scientist from Western Australia to talk about water management. Again, you know, very astute to go to a place like Australia where water, I think they're the best in the world in the way they think about water, Western Australia in particular. They don't get a lot of rain, so they have to be very mindful of all the water that they get. There's technical tours, Bruce. We're going to visit Central Park. We're going to visit Yankee Stadium. We're going to visit the Red Bull Arena, where the MLS Red Bull team plays. There's pre-tour and a post-tour. I like to say, I think I said, and you corrected me early on when we were talking about the conference at a different time. You said, yeah, it's happening in New Jersey and we're doing it, but it's an American conference. So will the attendees be visiting other places in America as well?
Oh, yeah. Basically, we have a pre-conference tour to Washington, D.C. and the Philadelphia area, which is going to be superb. Frank, I wish I had time to go on that tour. I'm going to be organizing a tour up here. I'll organize the conference, but it's going to be a spectacular tour. Anybody wants to get more information, just simply Google 13th International Turfgrass Research Conference, and they'll be able to get
it. Yeah, or it says turfsociety.com, ITRC 2017 would get them there. But I can't let you go until we talk about this little session reception Monday evening we're doing for Dr. Watson. What a nice touch for you guys to honor, probably with Jim Beard. Maybe, oh, of course, before Doc Watson would be correcting me right now if he was here. Before Jim Beard got around, I was here. Dr. Right. Watson used to tell me. And we'll honor him Monday night with the reception. That's a really nice touch, Bruce.
Well, I tell you, I appreciate that. And it's something we really wanted to do. And I think people are probably getting a flavor for what they're hearing right now. Is this is going to be an incredibly fun conference. It's going to be educational like none other. But I tell you, if we don't – my feeling basically, if this couldn't be a fun conference, I didn't want to do it. And so the culmination of this conference actually is going to be a Twilight Dinner Cruise on Thursday night around the Statue of Liberty. And we're expecting for that a full crowd for that for sure.
Well, we'll all be looking forward to it, Bruce. And I don't want to take one more minute of the time that I am so pleased that you were generous enough to spend with me on the show here. And I wish you nothing but the best and great success, which I know it's already a success. The research conference that I know you are right. You've been working on for the last 7 or 8 years. So thanks for taking the time, Bruce, not just for this, but for everything that you do.
And Frank, I appreciate it. And I'll put one more plug for anybody who's interested in sponsoring this event. There are still sponsorship opportunities.
There we go. There you go. Bruce Clark, shilling for the International Turfgrass Society. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers. Thanks for joining.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.